Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fragment 43. I heard all fascists are bad kissers.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is TalkArt.
Welcome to TalkArt.
This is a TalkArt Live, Rob. Where
Talk
are we?
TalkArt Live.
Where are we?
We are today in Margate.
Woo!
What a surprise.
How are you feeling today, Robert?
Well, today, Russell, I am feeling like I'm on literary drugs.
Oh, okay.
Because last night, a globally renowned artist said to me, "Are you on literary drugs?" Because I was so excited about today's talk. Because today we are interviewing and discussing the new poetry collection by a poet and writer, and actually a multidisciplinary writer. So it's a very complicated, multi-hyphenated word there. But I'm just feeling like I'm on literary drugs. Do you know why? Because Margate is not only a location now for art, it's also a location for great writers. There are so many amazing political thinkers here and incredible writers. I could like list them all off if you want.
Yeah.
Like Liv Little, Emma Dabbery,
Mendez
is our newest like
addition.
Mendez, who wrote Rainbow Milk, one of my favourite books, has moved here. And we're also we're in the presence of greatness. We have Sean Fay here today,
Woo!
Who wrote one of my favourite books.
So
I'm feeling like I'm in literary heaven.
Yes.
So I might seem like I'm on drugs. Anyway, so today we are here to celebrate the launch of a beautiful new collection of poetry called Unutterable Visions, Perishable Breath. And it has a beautiful artwork on the front cover, which we'll be exploring. And I know that art has played a really important role in our guest's life to this point, this very point here in Margate.
Yeah.
So we would like to welcome to TalkArt, O Tamere Gubadia!
Thank you for having me. I feel great.
What's
great to be here.
What's it like being in Margate, O Tam?
What's it like being in Margate? Have you seen the film Get Out?
Oh,
no, it's amazing.
Yeah, drink some water.
It's honestly amazing to be here. It's rare to be in a place. It's the opposite of London because everyone is really enthusiastic to be here, whereas in London everyone hates it but will never leave. So yeah, it's great. Everyone wants, you know, everyone's very encouraging about moving to Margate. It's nice to be by the sea, I imagine.
Are you tempted to move here?
Honestly, I feel like. I've destroyed my reputation in London. No, I haven't destroyed my...
Nearly.
moved to Margate in disgrace. I mean, isn't that why half the room... I'm genuinely tempted.
Does it feel important to you to be surrounded by creatives in your life? Are you surrounded by creatives in London?
Yes. I guess all of my friends, pretty much most of them, are creatives. I think it's important. I was making some really unhinged jokes about how a bunch of people I knew were the new Bloomsbury set. But I think it's interesting because like with things like with any sort of like community or you know, when people like move to a place to pursue like art as a passion, I think that like beautiful things come from that community. Humour comes from being surrounded by artists, inspiration comes from being surrounded by artists. And also I think it's
being surrounded by creative people who are so much more successful than me, I think inevitably pushes you to try and do better and try and channel yourself into your work more. Yeah, I definitely, it is important to me.
So you've just launched in last month in January.
One month today, actually. Today's the one month today. Anniversary.
Happy birthday. you've just launched your first poetry collection. Yeah. It's your debut book, isn't it?
My debut book.
Yeah.
My first and my last.
And I thought it'd be a really beautiful way to start to talk about the four sections, because it's actually in four very distinct kind of sections and tones of voice. And the titles are Ikor, which is a kind of like the blood of gods, essentially.
Yes, in sort of Greco-Roman mythology, Ikor is the blood of gods. Yes.
And apparently, if humans touched that liquid, they would actually die.
Yes.
Which I never knew. I learned that today.
So, yeah, so the four sections, it's, if I'm correct, it's Ikor, which replaces blood. But it's I've split the book into four parts based on the humours and humorism, which is just like it's an ancient set of beliefs that kind of persists to today. But it's the idea that, like, your temperament, your mood, perhaps what you are, what you do and what you're destined for, your inclinations are all dictated by the various balances or imbalances in the body. You know, like, melancholy is from, I believe it's yellow bile.
Black bile.
Black bile.
Yeah.
Melancholy is black bile. And then you have, like, you know, being phlegmatic, which is... But, yeah, I chose that because I often feel... I was trying to capture the kind of tides that almost feel like they... moved me and others, but like I was trying to capture the sort of ineffable, uncontrollable quality of what it is to live and to love and to be this like creature, like pulled in several different directions, and to feel like you have absolutely zero control over what it is you desire and what it is that moves you. And I wanted to like reflect that. I actually did get read down in quite a positive review, but they mentioned that it was meant to represent this sort of like chaos, the chaos of being, the chaos of being a person. But I realized that also the structure in itself is kind of like a fiction, because, you know, in trying to create this work that was like unbound to, you know, categories and reflected like the chaos of my mind and the chaos of other people's minds, the sections are all pretty much evenly split. The reviewer could not detect what the difference between them was, and I, in my opinion, that's because, you know, it's deliberate. Sure.
I like the fact that you described like the mind just being, you've described it as the uncurated mind.
The uncurated mind.
Whereas the body, you feel, has been heavily curated.
Absolutely. And I think that's often the only thing I can control is what I wear and how I look. And it's interesting because I used to think when I felt ugly, and I talk about this in the book, I used to think when I felt ugly that, like, being beautiful and feeling beautiful would be a thing that, like, saved me and a thing that made me feel better and, you know... But then, I got beautiful.
Well, no, you were always beautiful.
I was always beautiful. I just, you know, I just didn't realize. I took off my glasses and I had my like Hollywood transformation moment. But then, no, there's Lupita Nyong'o says that her mother used to tell her when she was younger, and Lupita Nyong'o being one of the most beautiful women in the world, it's really interesting that she was a woman who didn't feel beautiful for a variety of reasons. But you can't eat beauty is what Lupita Nyong'o's mother used to say to her. And like the older I get, the more I realised that it is it's so true. I had a poem in there called A Man Lies Here Still Unmade, and there's a line about I've had the clothes and the manners, and I've fought wars, attrition, shock and awe. And it doesn't... I realised that the curation of my body, the curation of myself, the desire to be this perfect thing, which no one can ever be this perfect thing, but the striving to be some sort of like perfect thing by some sort of weird perfect standard was... I mean, it's my mind... is crumbling, you know, under the weight of like that expectation. And it's a standard that I don't think anyone else holds to me. Like, it's one I hold for myself. But aesthetics are often the only thing that you feel like you have control over. And even then, sometimes you don't. The qualities, you know, what's going on inside, the internal aspects, even the external aspects are things that you cannot control. But the way I looked was always... for the last decade, 15 years, was something that I could control, and so it's something I dedicated mine to. But it hasn't... Clothes are armour, but they haven't satisfied you know, the yearning at the core of my soul. You can look good and you can look as good as you want, but if things are missing from your life, then they will be missing, you know, no matter how well-dressed you are.
Some of these poems are a decade old.
Yes.
So you've been on this journey through your creativity, through writing.
I really have. It's so interesting. There are things I wrote in this perhaps last summer. There are even things that I wrote in this perhaps 8 years ago. And I read them now and I'm like, lord, I don't believe that anymore. it's constantly like in flux, which is the interesting thing about having to...
Do you still like them though as poems?
Yes, I like them. I like some of the... There are things in this that, not say that I hate, but there are things in this that weren't consummate, that didn't quite say what I wanted to say. But that's also the nature of living is there is some ineffable quality to what we feel, that the moment we try and speak into words, it already... There's been a failure at that point, because I think that so much of our experiences as people, that they are ineffable. It's hard to speak what we truly feel. Words fail us the moment we begin to use them. And so 8 years ago, I wrote some of these things and that I still feel very moved by. But then there are things in it that I'm not sure that I'm convinced by that, by the logic of it, by the politic of it, by what's in the lines. But then I think to myself, that's perhaps evidence of growth, but also nothing's ever finished or perfect. I think that like the big struggle with this debut was just sending off the final manuscript and being like, whatever is in this, you know, it's done and it has to be done. And I think what I'm grateful for and what I'm excited about is just, you can like mull over creating the perfect work nonstop your entire life, but you will never be a part of the conversation unless you finish something and you put it into the canon and into the conversation. And so this is my humble offering into the canon. I mean, some of those things I wrote when I was perhaps 20 or even 19. Actually, some of the phrases are probably from like teenage years, but some of the things I wrote last summer. It's been a real long journey and I can almost see how it charts, but I'm glad it's done and I'm looking forward to what comes next.
Well, you're proud of it. You can stand by it and say this is...
Am I ever proud of anything? Yes, I am proud of it. I can stand by it and say, I've my friend is a very good playwright, Sam Gabiner, and I was doing this kind of thing in the beginning when the book was being published. I was having these sleepless nights where I literally would like wake up in the middle of the night and be like, oh my God, I've written a total pile of shit. This is awful. And everyone's going to literally throw tomatoes at me. And then I spoke to him about it. And he just said, the only thing you can do is ask yourself, was the work honest? And was this an honest reflection of that period in my life? And I can say with certainty, it is as honest as I could have been.
One of the words that keeps being repeated in writing around your work when people respond to it or even discuss it, like friends of mine have mentioned it too, is the word lyrical. And also I think there's a real intense romance within the way that you put words together. And I know you've described it as like sentimentality, but for me it's more romantic than sentimentality. But can you speak a bit about this lyrical sort of go-to that you have when you pick up the pen?
Why is sentimentality seen as something negative? My favourite actor is Robin Williams.
That's a great choice.
He always gets called as, oh, he's sentimental, as if it's a negative. I don't understand why sentimentality is negative.
Do you know what I think is... I think that sentimentality is negative because I think that fundamentally earnestness is a very difficult position to occupy. And poetry can be so difficult because poetry is fundamentally an earnest exercise. And I think that we are so used to living our lives through layers and layers of irony. And I think that like so much of like our modern society and even our modern socials, like even the comedy that like exists, so much of it is about a world reflected through layers and layers of irony. Everyone's afraid to be caught feeling or to be caught saying things that could demonstrate that they have a heart and there's vulnerability in that. It's all very, I think it's sad. And I think that like, it's like, even my friends who have perhaps made fun of the nature of my writing, the cloyingness or the saccharine quality to it, I think are often embarrassed of how those feelings make, how she's locked up. It's Tracy's
stuff. Oh, Tracy Emin.
Tracy Emin's trying
Tracy
to get,
Emin
into,
is
the
trying to get into the venue and can't get
she's
in. She's put, literally
she's
like,
pushed her head up against
she's
the window.
She's actually knocking against the window, trying to get in. Someone's
come in,
locked
come
the
in.
Door.
Come in.
Come in.
The Queen
we
of
love you, Tracy.
Yay!
And Lorcan O'Neill, we love him.
There we go.
Anyway.
Yes. Sentimentality and romanticism.
I think that people are, in our modern age, are deeply ashamed of earnestness because it reflects feeling, and feeling reflects vulnerability, and I think it's easier to not be. And our poetry, no one ever, people very rarely feel entitled to call themselves like poets. I never really considered myself a poet for years. And I think that I never had problems with the medium. I've always loved the medium, but I think that there was definitely a self-consciousness about it. Because other people, like, yes, there are bad poets, but poetry is perhaps the literary form that is mocked most, I would say. It's easy to mock because these are people saying, you know, I feel all of these things and I'm going to write them down. I'm going to try and create, like, you know, some sort of like vast and like significant imagery. And yes, obviously it strays into the pretentious, but I feel like that's still meaningful and wonderful. And I also think the kind of people who really despise, you know, poetry and the sentimental in, like, you know, cheesy films or like even films that have, like, you know, highly emotional subject matter, are afraid of something within themselves. I think they're afraid of vulnerability within themselves, and I think that that's what is reflected in their terror of other people being vulnerable.
And what about the lyrical?
The lyrical part, yes. I often think that a lot of the poems I wrote in the piece were meant to be read out, and I often, when I write, I'm thinking about, like, sort of, like, orally, in both senses, how something sounds and comes across. But I also think it's fun. It's playful. It's the part of writing that excites me most is trying to create something that is lyrical. And I love a pun. I love a pun that no one else recognizes but me. I love a double entendre. I love all of the literal. Some of the words I was thinking. But I love the actual, like, playing with the lexicon and, like, exploring it and, like, exploring words. And sometimes, you know, I love to make up a word and just say that it's a neologism, but there's a couple of made-up words in that book. No one notices when you make up words. It's actually incredible.
What are some of your made-up words?
Oh, microcosmology. That is not a phrase. Microcosmology is not a phrase that I could find anywhere else. But it reflected, like, in my opinion, that reflected a need within language. And I was here to
you're
very
feeling,
kindly
you're
fill.
Feeling that
I'm
gap.
Filling the gaps in English lexicon, like. I am.
In your humble way, yeah.
This is my humble offering to the canon, which has made it 10 times better.
So when it comes to themes, there's many themes in your work. It's all autobiographical, but the queer experience, especially the queer black experience, is central to your practice.
It is. It's interesting because I think that both experiences, both queer and black experiences, are definitely... they're represented in here, but I actually thinking about it now, I'm not sure how much they overlap, but perhaps they overlap in within me. And yeah, thematically, I started off, there is a lot about love and lovelessness. And I think I was thinking a lot about, you know, what often felt like inalienable character flaws within me. I often wondered how much of this is, you know, because a star danced above the hospital I was born in, and that's why I'm, like, mental. I always wondered, like...
because of what?
So in, like... I believe it's Much Ado About Nothing. Yes, I think Much Ado About Nothing. Beatrice says, a star danced, and under that I was born. And she blames her wild temperament on precisely this. And I sometimes joke, being like, how much of this is because of the arrangements, guys. I mean, like horoscopes and zodiacs, people are very interested in them. I'm deeply agnostic about them. I think that they're a very interesting and exciting, like, exercise, but, you know...
They're good when you're dating. So I was like, what star sign are you? And you Google it, and you're like...
We're so compatible.
Let's go for a drink.
I have seen people make very major life decisions based on horoscopes. And to each their own, like why not, you know, like, but yeah, it was love and lovelessness and that kind of agency, trying to figure out how much power do I actually have within my own life? How much of this is dictated by biology? How much of even what seems like an original thought in my mind is just the ones and the zeros and, like, little gray cells? I was trying to figure out if I could have any real ownership of my life, if I was in the driving seat. And I feel like that's thematically is one of the things that really
really like pours through, but like love and family, and occasionally like, you know, just like funny, slightly humorous observations. But yeah, that's thematically, I think, that what I was. And it's also, look, if there are themes that run through it, but also at the same time, it's just this swirling and sometimes disconnected, sometimes slightly like mad and incoherent thing. Because something I say in the introduction is that I don't believe that our bodies are sites of coherence. I think that like in one way or another, we are all mad and we're all bending and contorting ourselves to fit into these boxes that make us seem legible to other people. And I honestly, I haven't written this book to make myself legible to other people.
Does it help you know yourself better?
Yes, precisely that. I think that it's made me more legible to myself. And whatever other people take from that, that's beautiful. And I hope that people can relate. But that's really why I wrote this. You know, when I talk, initially it was called, the working title was initially Thoughts in a Body Too Long Curated. And I thought about all of the, I don't know, I think often about public life and all of the bullshit that public life entails and like trying to, and just dealing with such a complicated social scene and social world. And I just, you know, I'm tired of curating myself and my body. I say.
So here looking fabulous. Yeah.
But this is just, you know, this is just natural. But I'm tired of curating. I'm tired of worrying so desperately about what every single person thinks. I used to, you know, there's the phrase, you can't be all things to all people. I had a version of that, which was, if you can be all things to all people, then why not be? And I tried for a long time to
That's
be all
exhausting.
Things.
That's exhausting.
Oh my God, you don't understand the half of it. I'm so exhausted. And I used to think that I could, I used to think there was some magical realm where there were perfect words and perfect actions in which I could please everyone. Obviously that's not true. And it took me longer than I'd like to admit to realize it's not true. I still struggle with it right now. But I wanted to give up the charade. I want to give up sort of the facade and be something realer and more honest and speak like realer and more honestly about all of it. I hope that I've accomplished that. And if I haven't, you can buy book two.
In your poem Fragment 99, number 99, you say queerness is evidence of more. As
the
opening
image and the likeness.
Yes. Yeah, I can you talk about that as an idea?
Because yeah,
I found
can
that.
You can you read it out?
Oh
then?
Yeah, read it out actually, because it's only a short one as well.
Fragment 99. Queerness is evidence of more. Evidence of the image and its likeness to peek into the cauldron at the beginning of all things. It is evidence that we, in acting against nature, might usurp it. Queerness is evidence of the divine, proof that all equations may be endlessly rewritten. Queerness is water from the stone, Lazarus from the depths, something from nothing.
Love.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What I was thinking about when I was trying to, when I wrote Fragment, was that 99? Yeah. Queerness is evidence more. I think that when you, like, for example, I went to a Catholic all-boys school in Lagos. Like, you can imagine how that went. I actually loved it more than you'd think, but... wow. Like, all of you, all shameless. Can you all, like, behave, please? I then went to an all-boys school in Buckinghamshire, which is... yeah. Old boys school for the last 15 years. But what I was saying is, look, I'm a failed Catholic of the most traditional variety. And I think that what I was thinking of when I wrote Queerness Evidence of More is you're taught from a very young age and also in all media, in the Bible, in all sorts of like texts and media, you're taught that queerness is a kind of negation. You know, it's an unnatural negation. It's something that that acts against life itself, you know. And any queer person, and there are, from the looks of it, many of them in the audience, will tell you. Any queer person will tell you that if you've experienced, the divinity of love and attraction and romance, no matter how badly it ended. But if you've ever been in like the thick of it, I think that you realize that idea of queerness as a negation could not be far from, like, further from the truth. Like there is something
beautiful and unspeakable that erupts, you know, when people are in love, and it's indistinguishable, you know, from any heterosexual relation that you might, you know, consider, indistinguishable at the core of it. And I truly believe that, and I think that if you've experienced desire, if you've experienced, you know, especially desire that is reciprocated, you realize that this is the most beautiful thing in the world, and there's no amount of, if anything, it's interesting because out of nothing, out of a place that we are told is not fertile ground, the most beautiful flowers spring up, and that was the idea behind it.
I love that. Oh, that's totally beautiful. Did you grow up with art? I know your parents were academics, right?
No, they're lawyers.
Right.
Okay. To be fair, I also was very nearly a lawyer. The only reason I have a law degree, which is very fine. Everyone's always like, what? Yeah, I have a law degree.
Or it says on your website, jurisprudence.
Jurisprudence.
Is that like...
It's a very pretentious way of saying law. I didn't come up with it. I did not come up with that.
So how did you find writing then? You studied law because that's very... different, right?
Transferable skills. Dullest transferable skills in the world. How did I find law? I think that in the beginning, I was really excited because I was like, oh my God, this is a chance to prove how smart I am. And then I very quickly realized that I possess no passion for the law beyond proving how smart I am. So that wasn't going to be like, that wasn't going to be a viable career. We're going deep into the law, but I almost changed courses after my first year. But then I got my results and I did really well. And the arrogance, the arrogance in me was like, oh my God, I could do this. Reader, I could not. and it was not fun. I think right up until my final year of university, I interviewed at like Freshfields in like League Laters. So how awful. Can you imagine me swanning around some like London off? I would have jumped out of a high window very quickly. But writing was always the thing that I loved and always the thing that I felt like I was good at and wanted to do. And so the moment something clicked. My like doing 9 hour, doing nine 3 hour exams, no, 10 3 hour exams, 9 3 hour exams, space of 10 days was not, I think that was, I was done by that point. And I realized that there is a world in literature, there is a world in expressing yourself in literature. And I, you know, if this is the only thing that I ever get to write, if I get hit by a train tomorrow, then I, you know, I will still be thoroughly satisfied in the, you know, when I'm fading out of consciousness. Because writing is exciting and it's beautiful and it's sexy and it's I don't think that anything has given me an opportunity to understand myself more than actually putting pen to paper.
Do you write every day?
No, I don't have that kind of discipline.
How often do you write?
When the spirit moves me.
When you have a book.
When I have a book. No. How often do I write? Honestly, I think I struggle with deadlines for this very reason, in that I don't know, not to be like, you know, I don't sit there, I'm like, Virgil, singing me muse. I'm not, it's not that. But, I mean, maybe it's a bit that. But I actually don't have any sort of like devoted practice of writing. Literally, when the spirit moves me, I have a million notebooks, and the notes app is very useful, not just for apologies. And I use that, and I'd say I write more than one time a week, but like I don't have the discipline of some of my much, much more disciplined and more focused like writer friends who will go and sit down for several hours and produce many, many reams of very good quality work. I have to wait for
inspiration.
Do you have recollections of art growing up in Lagos?
I do have recollections of art. I actually, it's so interesting. I remember, and I'm trying to remember what specific, that we have a couple of national museums. And there was a car that one of our military leaders was assassinated in. And I remember going to the museum as a child and running my hand over like the bullet holes, because, I mean, it was it's not just Lagos, you're fine, you're allowed to touch the art, in my head anyway. But my parents had, my father is like a huge art enthusiast, and so our house in Lagos was filled with primarily like art, like primarily like Nigerian and African art, like for all of my childhood. And I that is something I remember so vividly.
What's the most vivid work then that you remember like living with? Was there something you'd pass on the way to school or something you'd look at while you're eating breakfast, for example?
There were a couple of pieces. There was one, and I'm like, as you might tell from the reference to, I'm obsessed with geles, which a gele is a kind of like traditional Nigerian head tie. And actually, it's so funny that you meant like right on the spot. I remember there was, and I think perhaps my father was also kind of obsessed with them because there was these. This beautiful, I wouldn't call it piecemeal, but it was, I'm trying to think of a good style, but it was, there was a trend within, I would say within Nigerian art, or like a certain quality of creating paintings that had a lot of texture, but not just like texture, but like more raised elements using like paint and other things. And I just remember from my childhood, different iterations of that, of women in geles, which is like a spiraling Yoruba head tie, and I remember distinctly that like kind of like composite portrait walking past that every day. It was those are some of my earliest memories of art. It's just the art that my father curated around the house. A man of great taste.
And art inspires your work. Like you go to museums, and there's certain artists. I think earlier on I asked you who you like, and you said you like Yves Klein, as you described him as a bullshitter.
He is such a bullshitter, and like I fully relate. Yves Klein, and IKB, like just
Yves Klein Blue,
yeah, which he calls International Klein Blue, and it's very interesting because, first of all, you didn't make up the fucking color, but I will say the branding is. I'm obsessed with him. I'm obsessed with with the things he would say about blue has no dimensions. You know, his kind of practice was this kind of like pseudo spiritual, very like French, very like he was a bit of un petit peu charlatan, but I love that. I love that quality. I love a charlatan that's actually a talented artist, but also like you can tell that some people are like, he was so high from his Yves Klein Blue Kool-Aid, and he really bought into everything that he said. And I say all of this. Oh my god, I'm going to get cancelled. I say all of this to say that I love Yves Klein, and there are two versions of the same painting, which is just like a giant. It's just a giant, effectively blue canvas. So I'm not talking to microphone. It's a giant blue canvas, which is just painted in his trademark shade. And he also does beautiful things with like figures of Venus, but it's not work that is complex. And I like that. I like that, but he's still managed to create this deep lore and this deep mysticism behind his obsession with the color blue. But Yves is just like, if I could steal a painting.
Oh, that's the final question. Don't go there. Don't go there yet.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah.
I think we should go to the kiss. So the front cover of the book has a kiss with flames, and it's an artwork by Mel Odom, who we'll talk about in a second. But there's also a poem in the centre of the book, which can you quickly read before we talk about Mel's work and the cover and why you chose that painting?
Fragment number 2. Kiss is a unit of measurement. How we count the courage it takes to close the gaps between people. I'll hand it back to you.
Oh,
sweet, right?
I love the bit about We count the courage it takes to close the gaps between people. And the idea of a kiss and how it's actually, a kiss is just two bodies coming together. It's not even material.
No,
but it's something
not.
That can actually change the world in a way.
Yeah, I think that's like spot on. I think it's something that's, it's not material, it's fleeting, but also I think, you know, I don't think that we'd have any of art or literature without the kiss. I think the kissing is actually a recurring theme in this book because I'm such a lover boy of taking proposals at the end.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, and so kissing was a recurring theme. Actually, it's almost, I wouldn't call it coincidental that I ended up with that cover, which is in many ways perfectly thematic, because I think, you know, why I chose Icor, why I chose all of these things, there was a certain feeling that like love gives you, and sometimes that feeling is firmly rooted in delusion, but there is the reason I chose Icor is because there are the ways in which love feels like inhaling godhood, and it feels like, you know, becoming something powerful and far greater than you were on your own. And I think that, like, you know, That tempo is very much about that, about the feeling of living like gods, you know.
But if you're in love, you feel like you can live like a god.
Yeah, if you're in love, and I think sometimes when you're in love, you feel like you are a god. It certainly feels divine. And
what are you when you're not in love then?
I'm not in love.
Melancholic.
Well, if you're a god in love, and when you're not in love, what do you think you are?
The devil. I don't know. I wouldn't even say that. I would say I'm every lowly and ordinary man. You know, I think that when I, like, actually, if in, I think it's fragment two, when I talk about the courage it takes to close the gaps between people, the thing I guess I was thinking about is we are all born with so much distance between us. And I certainly know that that's something that I felt. And what I love about a kiss, and I love writing about kisses, because for this brief moment, it's like you're investing in each other as like the sight of miracles. And I think that that's beautiful and special and unique. And also, there are so many interesting things when you think about, we actually don't know. There is no consensus about whether or not kisses are learned or evolutionary behavior. Like, we don't know. We've just been kissing for so long that we actually cannot tell. And so, in one of the poems, I play around with that. I play around with the origin. I create my own sort of like origin mythos about, you know, about kissing. But yeah, I'm meandering. Like,
so what about Mel's work? Because I know that Mel was an artist that you had already been a big fan of.
I have been obsessed with Mel Odom for years. Mel is this veteran New York illustrator. He still lives in New York. He's been working for the last 40 years. And I wanted him actually to do a bespoke illustration. I had this whole idea. And he told me, he was like, the older it gets, it's harder for him to like, you know, he's working through pain in his arm. He was like, you can go through my archive and choose anything.
Oh.
And use it for free. Which I was just like overwhelmed by. And like, I'm eternally grateful, because I see the book now and I think to myself, I can't imagine what else could be on this cover. I really don't. I think it's so perfect. I think what it says about love and passion and destruction and temptation. I think it's a beautiful image, and I'm very grateful to Mel for letting me use it.
How did you discover Mel's work?
Almost certainly Tumblr, like a
really?
Decade ago. Probably, yeah. I think it probably was Tumblr like a decade ago, and then I like looked into him and I followed him and engaged with all of his work for years and years and years. And he didn't, I mean, I guess he didn't know. So he didn't notice me. But I emailed him a while back about another project I was working on. And then we were kind of in touch. And then
has he allowed you to use another image, or have you got to pay for this one?
No. That was a project many ages ago. I kind of, now I've done this, I'm like, maybe every single book needs to have an image by Mel, but I'm sure at some point he'll sort of, like, to create like a nice, like, you know, I was going to say, create my own personal...
He's got an exhibition coming up in America. And yeah, and I think we're going to hopefully talk to him and interview him soon. We've been in touch ourselves, because I'd never even heard of him until I met you. And it's incredible, his body of work.
His body of work
is... Was he mainly in, like, magazines?
Yeah, so magazines, yeah. He did, but then the reason I got in touch with him, because he did also do illustrations for books, but mainly magazines. Like, he did like, yeah, advertising, yeah. Playboy. He did like Playboy. Back when Playboy would commission like a bespoke illustration for like one article in, like, you know, that sort of, like, that sort of thing that doesn't happen very much, but commission, but from, like, a really high profile, like, working illustrator. But I think there's, like, a sensibility and a quality to his work that, like, is just, I don't know. It's and he calls, he refers to his, like, pencil work as, like, slightly maniacal, because I think that, like, if you zoom in, the amount of detail and all of it's obviously quite hand-drawn. He's old school. But it's just, it's some of my favorite images of all time, really. And it feels like the honor of a lifetime to have his beautiful image. That's Burning Kiss from, I believe, 1989, is the image that he let me use for the cover, and I'm really grateful.
I know that you also love Warhol, and Warhol started out his life as an illustrator and was doing a lot of illustrations in magazines and Vogue and things like that. So can you speak a bit about your relationship with Warhol?
Do you know what? A couple of years back, the tape flew us to New York and Pittsburgh to, like, kind of recap Warhol's life.
Who's us?
Me and a group of, like, I was other journalists, and barely journalists, but me and a group of
writers.
It was a group of writers, effectively art writers, and it was a press trip unlike any other. I will say that we went to his family home. We met his family. We also interesting. There are so many interesting things about Warhol. For example, there are two halves of his family. He has two nephews that don't speak to their warring, they're basically warring factions of the family. One part of the family is in Pittsburgh, and they're in charge of the Warhol Museum. The other part is in New York. And he, like, writes about, like, he has, like, this beautiful book called Me and My Uncle Andy, and about, like, you know, his illustrating, but they don't. There's literally, like, a schism within the Warhol family.
I never knew that.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And I like Warhol. Like, I'm not going to be like, the art is iconic. It's really iconic iconography. But I like Warhol more for the fact that, like, speaking to people who knew him, there is no, first of all, he was obviously mental. But there was no, like, he used to do this thing. Whereas, obviously, Warhol's, and you could see in the museum, you could see his wigs. But he would wear a wig. You know, like, being like, this is my hair, I don't wear wigs. He'd go to the hairdresser, get his wig cut, and then he would go away for a couple of weeks, buy a longer wig, and go back to the salon and pretend that his hair had grown out. And obviously, they all knew it was a wig. But I'm obsessed with that, like, that level of, like, delusion. And it's something I truly aspire to. And I feel like, and or just all the accounts of Andy Warhol are, of a man who did not live very long ago, all the accounts of him are borderline apocryphal. Like, even speaking to people who knew him, some people are like, oh, he was shy and retiring. And then you speak to someone like Corey, who was, you know, who worked in the factory, and he was just being like, no, he was like a horny, like massive, like, pervert. And, like, no one has any of these. There is for a character that did not live 2,000 years ago, it's very interesting that, like, people cannot agree on the kind of man Warhol was. And that I find, like, quite thrilling.
Do you feel like there's anything like Warhol now, contemporary?
Contemporarily.
Or that kind of feeling at that time, the factory, all them people sort of descending on one individual.
I don't know if I see it within art. I think that kind of, like, deification is so much more evident within fashion. Like, I could point to several, like, contemporary, like, people within fashion who, I don't know, I think of, like, Ib Kamara, for example, who has such, like, a distinct visual language that everyone in, like, the last, like, 7 years has attempted to jack it. Like, like, you can see the progress within, like, within fashion of people who are just trying to replicate something that he's basically been doing since he was, like, at university. And, like, I think that his impact, you know, he's a creative director of Off-White now, and he's also, like, the editor of Dazed. And I think he's like a singular voice within really bringing, like, the art into fashion in like a beautiful way that I often felt like it was elements of, like, Afrofuturism. And, like, it was, yeah, I think of people who have, like, will have a kind of lasting cultural impact. I definitely think of someone like Ib.
You were an intern at a fashion magazine for a while. I read this amazing story that you, some wee trans.
Can I say what magazine? I mean, the magazine's now, it was InStyle. I worked at InStyle in the, InStyle, God, it was my, The stories I could tell about InStyle.
Well, there's an amazing story you tell about how you were having your appraisal.
It was
a great appraisal, but you'd really offended someone about a mirror.
Okay, and this is why everyone... Like, I like to think that I'm crazy, but everyone in fashion, like, genuinely unhinged. Okay, so I used to work at InStyle fashion cupboard. I was the fashion cupboard manager, which involved being very lowly paid and also
fashion cupboard manager.
I don't know if you've ever seen Ugly Betty. You might remember Christina, who like ran the fashion cupboard. I was Christina, and I was trying to train the interns. We once lost a pair of Celine earrings, which was basically an international incident because French Vogue wanted them right after us. Couldn't find them, and so we had to be like, this pair of Celine earrings, of which it's from a new collection. There's only one pair. We've lost them at InStyle magazine. That was a hellish day. But so I was having my an appraisal at this lovely fashion magazine, and my boss at the time, we'd been in the fashion cupboard a couple of weeks earlier. She came in, like, you know, glamorous woman, she was telling the story about how, you know, when she was at home, a mirror had fallen and broken. But she was like, you know what? She's like, I'm glad that no one like knocked it over and broke it, because, you know, 7 years bad luck. And I, being like the consummate know-it-all I was like, actually the correct superstition is that if a mirror falls and breaks on its own, someone will die within a month in your house. This did not go down well. I was just trying to give everyone the correct information. Did I ever believe that? No, but that was, I think, perhaps one of the only negative points in my appraisal was she brought up the fact that I told her that, and it freaked her out. And apparently that was like a legitimate thing to bring up in my formal appraisal.
Because she was thinking about her family.
Because she was thinking about someone. I'm sorry.
That's your fault.
It's my fault. It's not my fault. First of all, she was incorrect about the superstition. And second of all, it's a fucking... Oh God, love fashion.
Can fashion be art?
Yes. Like, absolutely. Without a doubt. I think conclusively. Is all fashion art? No. Look at the fucking Philip Pline. No. But can fashion be art? Absolutely.
If you think of performance and like Warhol and the legacy of that, like if you think of someone who's from a very different history, but Marina Abramovic, I know you've become friends with her. We actually went together to the opening of the Royal Academy, and Lindsay as well. Right. We all went to see her in London. And can you speak a bit about her work and also the friendship that has now grown?
Marina's going to be listening. She told me she liked you. Yeah, I mean, no, me and my bestie Marina Abramovic got our house on fire. No, she's just like, I think that people think that Marina Abramovic, like, I certainly thought that she would be one kind of person. And then you meet her and you realize that she's really fucking funny. Like, she's so funny. Like, cracking really hilarious jokes constantly. And I remember actually I think maybe it was the third time I met her. We were at some like dinner, and she like came over to huddle us, and she's like, "This is so boring." She's like, "I want to talk to the kids." And it's just everything. Yeah, she's like a woman who's like, I'm sure everyone has seen the clip where they ask her if she'd like to have dinner with Greta Gerwig or Kim Kardashian, and she says neither. And what I really appreciated about that, because she said, I grew up in, you know, so we didn't have these toys. You know, I played with invisible beings and shadows. And I actually, funnily enough, really relate to that. Not because we didn't have, like, you know, like toys growing up. But we're getting deep into the lore. I've had sleep paralysis since I was about 7, and I've had like really like long like bouts of sleep paralysis and like hypno and sleep time like hallucinations. And some of the earliest memories I have of like my childhood are seeing these figures, these like terrifying figures on the walls of my like childhood bedroom, and being half asleep, half awake. I've seen all sorts of things and that also does actually very much flood into the book, because I was trying to contend with the fact that in some very, very tangible sense, there's something about my nervous system, about my brain. Also, there's a whole pain empathy thing, which I can't bother to get into. But yeah, I really identify with the whole, you know, I only played with invisible figures and beings. It's like, oh my God, me too, during my childhood. That's all I saw was invisible figures and beings. Maybe I should talk to a doctor after this. But... I find her to be the most thrilling and fascinating and funny, like, and also like even the, something about the, even the macabre jokes that she made when she was talking about nearly dying, I deeply identify with, because I'm constantly making jokes about Anyway, but I think that there aren't... I think that Marina is a singular figure within culture. I think that there aren't many people that endure, that many people that get to, that throughout their lives get to so determinedly make the kind of work that they want, work that is... But also, it's thrilling partly because it was so dangerous, but she did get hurt. People actually did hurt her. People picked up the loaded weapons and pointed them at her. People cut her. I think that you have to be mad and also to have some really divine quality within you to throw yourself into that kind of work and to throw yourself to it for a lifetime. I want to be the Marina Bambridge when I grow up. I very much want to be an artist that is that present.
You dedicate the book to the women in your family.
Yes.
And you said that I am not often the best version of myself, but on the days that I am, it is because of you. And there's this beautiful poem, which is one of my favourites, which is for your sister. Mm. Can you read that, actually? Because it's another short one. Yeah. But also, can you speak a bit about, like, the women in your family and how important women are to you?
I love how I keep on picking up the book. I know most... Like, I can literally... It's nicer. It's a nicer image for me to read from the book. For my sister. I keep a photograph of you and I when we were young on my bedside table. It is a kind of contagion magic, a ritual by which I hope to overwhelm the worst parts of me with your goodness, unwed the shame from my very bones. Where's my wow, Rob?
Wow.
Thank you.
OTAM was trying to outdo my wows, because wow. Obviously my favourite catchphrase is wow on Talk
Art. Yes, wow.
And extraordinary. Also extraordinary.
I love the reviews. I love them. They're just so... It's clearly from one bit.
Oh yeah,
person.
My troll. I have a troll who basically slagged me off for saying wow too much, and that I need to get off the show,
but
and
Robert,
it needs to be Russell on his own.
Russell's great.
Yeah, Russell's great. It's always I hate Robert, but I love Russell. Yeah.
I'm sorry about that.
Yeah, it's okay. I forgive you.
It's actually wow. Russell.
Anyway, talk about the women in your life.
The women in my family. So that poem, if we were to think about it in archetypes, I often thought that I was like, growing up with my family, I was kind of like the ingenue, and my sister was the genius. Like I wouldn't say growing up. It's so interesting. Growing up in her shadow, which is I was the neglected middle child. Growing up in her shadow because she was just so. My sister is astonishingly brilliant, and she's good at everything that she's ever tried. And that pushed me to try and be better. Because I often feel like when you're sort of this proto-queer, this child that sometimes people are mean to for reasons that are not discernible to you at that moment, I think you internalize all of it. And I just always, and I still think this now, actually, I think sometimes it's hard for me to, when I'm not with them, it's hard for me, even when I am with them, I think that I'm sometimes, Wolf writes, or I guess as Sasha and Orlando have this discussion in Orlando, being like, why are you sad? And I often find myself like sometimes on the verge of tears when I am with my sisters, because I'm so, something about their company is so good that I often think to myself, what if this is the last time? And that's such an intense thing to feel every time I see them, but they are shining paragon beacons of kindness and of selflessness and of restraint and containment, and they are in many ways everything that I will never be, and I think that, and that's not a bad thing, but I often, the days when I'm around them, I'm a better person, and I think that thinking about them makes me want to be better. It makes me want to be a better man. It makes me want to show people the kindnesses that I've seen them experience, the integrity that even my little sister, like, she just has so much integrity. And I think to myself, I want to be like you, to possess it. I feel like in many ways I'm too worldly a person. I'm too wedded to like pleasures of the flesh. And, and I think that both of my sisters are just, they're the antithesis of me. And that is both terrifying and beautiful, because in any universe, in any circumstance, if I could do this all, I would choose them every single time. And so, yeah, I think that the women in my family are wonderful. I often think that my mother is
is the kindest person I know, without any doubt. She doesn't seem to have the capacity for wickedness that me and my father do. I'm kidding. If he listens to this, it's going to be a great conversation. But no, it doesn't have that capacity for meanness, or she doesn't seem to have that capacity for selfishness that drives other people, that sometimes drives me, even though I like to think I'm a very selfish person. And yeah, and so just these qualities, like, I sometimes like will their goodness into me by osmosis, or just, you know, it's hard to be around them because I'm thinking of leaving and how hard leaving is.
Have some red wine. Well, before we get on to our final questions, can I take this opportunity to read from another poem, a poet?
Yes, please.
One that means a lot to you, Mary Oliver.
Mary Oliver.
Can you talk about Mary's work? Because actually you told me about her and I've now gone into a bit of a Mary Oliver rabbit hole.
Okay, right. Isn't she fantastic?
Beyond.
Like, so I think there are some poets that people often... again, make fun of because earnestness is something to be punished. Earnestness is embarrassing. Oh my God, you have feelings. Ugh. But Mary Oliver, her adoration of the natural world, of letting go, of finding healing in the natural world, of living in the moment. I think, and these seem like nebulous and trite things I'm saying, but you pick up a Mary Oliver poem, you read Wild Geese or the Summer Day, and this quality of accepting the world as it is and seeing the minutiae, the beauty of it is something I think that Mary Oliver is, if ever there was a poet as a guide to life, I believe that it's Mary Oliver. I really believe that.
Can I read just two poems? They're quite quick. First one is titled Don't Hesitate. If you suddenly and unexpectedly feel joy, don't hesitate. Give in to it. There are plenty of lives and whole towns destroyed or about to be. We are not wise and not very often kind, and much can never be redeemed. Still, life has some possibility left. Perhaps this is its way of fighting back, that sometimes something happens better than all the riches or power in the world. It could be anything, but very likely you notice it in the instant when love begins. Anyway, that's often the case. Anyway, whatever it is, don't be afraid of its plenty. Joy is not made to be a crumb. Isn't that amazing?
It's incredible.
And then this other one, which is quite poignant, is called The Uses of Sorrow. And she says, in my sleep, I dream this poem. Someone I loved once gave me a box full of... Oh, I'm going to cry. That's annoying.
It's only one more line, though. You've got what, two sentences.
I'm trying not to cry.
All right.
You can do it.
Someone I loved once gave me a box full of darkness.
It took me years to understand that this, too, was a gift.
There you go. That's, oh my God. That's, thank you for that's so introducing beautiful. Me to her work. That's a bit dramatic, isn't it? Sorry,
no,
guys.
No, it's heartfelt.
No, it's I cry often, which I like. Would you like, audience? Do I seem like a person who cries a lot?
No.
Yeah. Coming from me.
What you didn't hear was Sean Fay really reassuringly going, "Yes, yes, you do." Well, I cry a lot. I know that I might not seem like it, but I cry a lot. I'm very moved. And Mary Oliver is a poet that moves me.
Yeah, isn't that amazing that poetry can do that? That's like four lines and suddenly it just goes straight to the heart, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that's what your work does for people.
I hope so. I hope also people feel empowered to write poems. And, you know, I think they like Corbyn got really
Jeremy.
he got really, really, I guess, pilloried for this specific opinion, which is the idea that there is a poet, you know, a painter in all of us, which is kind of devastating to think of that as like a legitimate criticism. But I think that, like, I hope that people feel empowered to go and write a poem. I hope that someone picks this up off the shelf and says to themselves, I can do this. Like, if he can do this, I can. And yeah. And just speaking about emotions and poems, I actually, there's a poem in here which I could not, bearing in mind, I wrote it, but I could not get through it without crying. The first time I got through without crying was maybe
a couple of actually at my launch because I couldn't cry because it was also if I started crying, I think then my sister would have started crying, but Winnie would have started crying. So I didn't, but I managed to get through it. But yeah, even the words that you write yourself to speak something can really pull something out of you.
Yeah.
And I think that's wonderful.
Right, final questions then. If you could do an art heist, you were about to say it earlier, but if you could steal any artwork in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
It would be, I still wanted the Yves Klein blue editions. Like the one
even though he's a bullshitter.
But because he's a bullshitter.
Right.
I'd absolutely. And like blue is my favourite colour.
That's the next question. Oh, babe, you're so poetic.
I'm
just
sorry.
Getting ahead of yourself. Can I ask the next question?
Yeah.
What is your favourite colour?
Yves Klein blue.
Money. Money is my favourite.
Green.
I want money. To be seen in green.
Yes.
No, but I would steal that. And I'd steal it from... Honestly, not to be like the Tate Modern doesn't have a lot of security, but the Tate Modern does not have a lot of security. And I really feel like if I were to really plan a heist, I feel like... This is something I used to think about all the time when I was younger, being like, how would I... Because art heists seem so fun. Like, I would love to be an art thief. Like, I'm saying on the Talk Art podcast.
As a real job. As a legitimate job.
Yeah. No. I don't know if you ever read about this, but really high-profile works of art that were in foreign museums, that were ancient, like, Chinese works, were suddenly going missing, stolen by what seemed to be highly professional teams of people who were leaving, behind no trace. And effectively what the implication was, the Chinese government was putting together these heist teams to go and steal works of art that had been stolen from initially, which is fab. I think so fab. I'm a big fan of that. I don't know, when I was younger, the careers I dreamed about, maybe it's Tomb Raider's fault, because I dreamed about being an archaeologist, because you know, I thought that like I would be on my Lara Croft tees. A little hot pound, a little dual pistol, like very cunt. I used to think that like heist films were some of my favorite films, and I just the idea of a heist, it's a thing that I like to think of as there's like a phrase that I came up with to describe when people.
It's just a made up word.
It's not a made up phrase. It's a phrase. Phrases can't be. It's not made up in the same way. It's just the tactical grace. You know when you like. I don't know when you watch like. I don't know Catherine Zeta Jones like cartwheeling like contorting herself over like red laser beams. I mean like that's an example of tactical grace. But it's I think it's a quality that happens in real life, but often more represented in art when someone is. This is such a rarefied level of skill and charm that they're able to pull off effortlessly something within the world of the show that feels quite like special to observe and magical, and I call it tactical grace. I'm not
it's a bit like Diana in The Traitors, isn't it, as well?
God, you're such a fag.
what is the best advice you've ever received in terms of your writing?
Don't. No. What is the best advice that I've... I think maybe it is Sam, but that's not necessarily about writing. I've received so much encouragement from so many people. I cannot list them all, but I do love Sam's advice, which is, you know, you can make a thing and you will spend all of your time wondering whether or not the thing was good, you know. And instead of worrying about whether or not it was good, worry about whether or not it was honest. And I think that is what I've made peace with, is that I do not think that this is perfect, you know. Is it the greatest contribution to the canon in the last 20 years? The jury's out on that. Maybe. But I don't think that it's perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But is it honest? Yes. And that's all I could hope for.
Well, thank you for your honesty.
Yeah, thank you.
Tamara, this has been amazing. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for having me.
Here.
I love you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, of course.
And also... Everyone who's going to get this book, either listening or in the audience, the thing I love about it as well is as an object, it really works so beautifully as an artwork because the typography and the layout and the rhythm of the actual visual of the words is so impressive, like as a book. And it's really fresh to me and it's really exciting. And my favorite page is where it just says, love me, 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 over and over again. Because I just need to be, because I'm acting as if I'm Russell Tovey, who wants to be loved. Who wants to be loved?
That's a burn.
Yeah, it is. It's well, just, we I had to be honest.
No. Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we want to thank the Fort Road Hotel for allowing us to be here today
thank
for
you
this.
Us.
We'd like to thank hotel. Quench Gallery in Margate.
Lindsay
and Guy, thank you very much for organising.
Gemma. We love Gemma.
Gemma up there. We'd like to thank them.
And everyone for coming on a Sunday to come, like, see me talk absolute shit.
Also, you're very fresh-faced. You're all looking really happy. There's it's no, like, dark. Hungover faces. I love it.
No, you are. And everyone listening, please go to at TalkArt, and we'll be posting images of what we're talking today.
And are you at Otamare?
I'm at Otamare on everything.
Perfect. And we'll be
all about branding, baby.
Only fans and everything. Right?
Exactly.
Brilliant.
We'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye. Woo!
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.